Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
My very special guest on this September 11 was in Washington as the Pentagon was targeted shortly after the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York on this day 10 years ago. It was a profound and timely experience for him to be in the United States at the time. He is the former Prime Minister John Howard. These events had a very significant impact on his prime ministership and particularly on his relationship with George W. Bush, the American president at the time. And Mr. Howard joins us now on Open House. John Howard, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Very grateful for your time. The first report you heard on September 11 and on the attacks was almost a casual aside, wasn't it?
It was. It was from my press secretary, Tony O'Leary, a few minutes before 9 o'clock. On that fateful morning, he was briefing me for an upcoming news conference. And he just said to me casually at the end, oh, by the way, a plane has hit one of the towers of the World Trade Center. And I said, gee, that's an unfortunate accident. Yes. And in my mind's eye, I recall thinking of a small plane, a light plane, hitting the tower. A few minutes later, he came back and banged on the door and said, look, another plane has hit the other tower, and we both then knew it was no accident. I turned on the television set, and we could see these terrible images of burning towers, and that, of course, was a signal to us that this was something quite dramatic, quite horrible. I went around to the news conference. I had something to say at the beginning of the news conference about how terrible it was and how we felt for the Americans. We were concerned about the loss of life and casualties. And then I answered some domestic questions, that is domestic to Australia, from the Travelling Australian News Party. And it was while I was conducting this news conference that Flight 77 was driven into the Pentagon. And my Secret Service detail told me after the conference was over that they'd heard the explosion on their radio frequency. We pulled aside the curtains and you could see the burning, see the smoke rising from the Pentagon, and it was therefore another piece of evidence that this was an orchestrated terrorist attack. My first thought, frankly, was for my wife and son. They had gone out earlier in the morning for a bit of sightseeing. The Secret Service people were in touch with their car and they established that they were okay. And then I went back to my room and was in pretty short all the time by my Secret Service detail that I had to leave the hotel and go to what turned out to be the basement of the Australian Embassy in Washington.
Like a bunker for your safety.
I call it, yeah, a bit like that. It was really the basement area, and over the next few hours quite a lot of Australians gathered there, and it was, I don't know whether it was in any way reinforced, I'm not sure, I didn't inquire. One of the interesting things is that although we knew immediately because of the nature of the attack that it was an horrific terrorist incident and had long-term implications in all sorts of ways, everybody was remarkably calm. There was no panic, there was open discussion about whether there might be another attack somewhere in America, whether there'd be an attack on London or Tokyo or whatever.
Or in Australia.
Or even in Australia. Because when I got to the basement, I rang John Anderson, who was the acting Prime Minister in my absence, to talk about it, and he said that he'd already had a meeting with senior security people and they'd put an exclusion zone around the American embassy in Canberra and had also provided additional security for the Israeli consulate and for some other Jewish assets in Australia. It was inevitably Israel and Jewish interests become targets for terrorist attacks because of the provenance of so many of them. So that goes on. They were the sort of things that one attended to immediately.
Can I tap into your private thoughts beyond your public responsibilities? Was there any fear in your mind or anxiety about what this really meant?
Well, in a strange way, there wasn't at that stage. I didn't feel any physical fear. I was I guess, philosophical. Well, you know, you can get taken out in an accident at any stage, and you know, life is good, but life, you know, there's always dangers. And I didn't feel any physical insecurity. I clearly worried about what this all meant for the future of our kind of society. Was this going to become a regular part of our lives? But interestingly enough, the mind and the emotions operate in a pretty rational way. When something like this happens, you think of the next thing that you have to deal with, rather than sitting down and thinking, "Oh my golly, what does all this mean?"
Yes.
You do that over time, but my immediate concern was, okay, well, I went to the basement. I wanted to talk to John Anderson. I then wanted to have a press conference. I wrote a letter to President Bush expressing my concern about what had happened. Obviously, he wasn't available to speak to any foreign leaders at that stage. He was incommunicado. And I talked to all the other Australians who were there. I got hold of my foreign affairs advisors and says, who do you think is responsible? What does this mean in the immediate future? What should I do about the rest of my trip? We pretty quickly decided that the address to the joint sitting of Congress would be cancelled, because obviously they would have other things on their mind.
That was planned for the following day.
That was planned for the following day, the Wednesday.
And that turned into a special sitting of the Congress.
Well, it turned into a special sitting of the Congress to condemn the attacks and to give the President all necessary authority to take whatever action he needed to retaliate. And I said to my advisors, look, there's no point in my going up to New York, which was the other part of the trip to America, because the whole atmosphere in which we were operating had changed. The best thing I can do is to return to Australia as quickly as possible. That is what I should, as Prime Minister, do.
Yes.
My mind and my time was preoccupied with those things. And then later in the day, we decamped to the residence of the Australian ambassador, Michael Thorley, and his wife, Debbie. We had a rather somber barbecue that evening, and I spent some time talking in the lounge room of the embassy residence, talking to Michael and others about what it all meant. And it was at that time that I think the first reference was made to the possibility of it being Al-Qaeda. And then the following day, of course, I went to the special sitting of Congress.
Where you were quite a significant spectator, as I
recall. Well, I was. We spoke to the Speaker's office and indicated that although I accepted completely that the address had to be cancelled, that I would like to be there as an expression of support. And I had what I regarded as a great privilege with my wife and the ambassador and his wife being the only people in the public gallery. No other members of the public were admitted for security reasons. And my presence was acknowledged, and I was giving what I found to be a very moving standing ovation lasting about 30 seconds as an acknowledgement of my presence and an expression of thanks for the gesture of solidarity and support that it represented. It was a very moving occasion.
Yes. In those discussions you mentioned with Australia's new ambassador to Washington, Michael Thorley, which took place on September 11, 12, you speak in your book, Lazarus Rising, that he, for the first time, mentioned that an attack on Iraq was likely as a result of this. Why do you think he drew that conclusion so early?
Well, he just thought that Iraq would be back on the agenda, and that was the expression he used. It was based on his knowledge that on both sides of the political aisle in America, Iraq was regarded as unfinished business, just as much from the Democrats as from the Republicans. There was a nagging feeling in America that it had been a mistake to have left Saddam in place in 1991. There was a strongly held belief that he had weapons of mass destruction, had stockpiles of them. There was a feeling that in the light of this attack, and they didn't think he was responsible.
No, that's the question.
No, yes. They weren't suggesting he was responsible. The Americans never suggested that to me. There were some people in Washington who might have believed he was involved, but I never saw any evidence that he was involved.
Which opened up a significant window of criticism for your opponents to say, well, what was the link? What was the link between September 11 and Iraq?
Well, the fear was very simple, that because Saddam was believed to have weapons of mass destruction, he would give them to terrorists and they might be used in a future attack against the United States or American or allied interests. That was the concern. And the feeling in many American minds was that given what had happened on the 11th of September, future behaviour of a similar kind or facilitated by Saddam should be preempted by him being dealt with under the Security Council resolutions.
On Open House on this September 11, we're with the former Prime Minister John Howard. Mr. Howard, as you reflect back on what is no doubt the weightiest decision a nation's leader can take to go to war, and knowing clearly your passionate defence of that decision with Iraq, do you remain as convinced with the passage of time and knowing what we do now that it was the right or the only course of action?
Well, I certainly do remain strongly of the view that it was the right action. Yes, I do. One of the things that we ought to remember is that in the last few years, on five occasions, the people of Iraq have voted in democratic elections, despite murder of some of their citizens to obviously prevent them voting and other fearful intimidation. In fact, the last election in Iraq, there was a slightly higher turnout to vote than there was in America in the election which chose President Obama. That indicates to me that there's a hunger for democracy and openness in that country. So I believe it was the right thing to do, and I don't regret having taken that decision.
You say in your book, Lazarus Rising, that September 11 changed the psychology of the US. Can I ask, from what to what?
Well, it made them feel very vulnerable. For months, indeed, several years after the 11th of September, the Americans were most fearful of another attack. They thought the 11th of September was the first of a number. And therefore, their psychology changed in that way in quite a big fashion.
Yes. As I said, the events of September 11 were very important in shaping what turned out to be an extremely close relationship with George W. Bush, a relationship with an American president that I think would be the envy of any Australian prime minister, past or present. What do you think it was that enabled you, beyond timing that you were there at the time, why did you both click as you both clearly did?
Well, I liked him and trusted him and found him on a personal basis an engaging, genuine man. He quite liked Australia. He'd read a lot about Australia. He didn't pretend to be an expert, but he communicated to me a clear interest above the average in our country. And he valued the alliance. We had similar views on a lot of things. We came from the same side of politics, although we had a few differences in relation to economic policy. There were some things that he did in economic policy that I didn't agree with, but they really related to his own country. So really, in a sense, not my business. But overall, he was a very likable man whose company I enjoyed.
It became very personal then, didn't it?
Well, it became quite personal. And one doesn't want to either overstate or understate it. We remain in touch.
Yes.
What that means is that when I go to Dallas, which I do from time to time because I have a son who's working there, I normally see George Bush and his wife, Laura, and we normally catch up and have a meal or a drink and a yarn. Now, it's that kind of relationship. I don't want to overstate it.
No, but you became his man of steel.
Well, that was a description he was kind enough to use in relation to me. He appreciated the support that we gave, and he also appreciated the candour that I brought to the relationship. We offered to do certain things but we made it clear we couldn't go beyond doing those things. And he always appreciated straight dealing, and there was always very open straight dealing between the two of us.
In those very open dealings, and over quite a period of time, as it turned out, which included these weighty deliberations on war, as two men who've both embraced questions of faith, was there ever any discussion about what God was up to on September 11?
No, not really. He was a person who was a deeply committed Christian. There's no doubt about that. But he was not somebody who inflicted it on others. He was somebody who talked consistently with his faith. And I respected him for that. He was a person who could relate to people who had faith and those who didn't. But he never apologised for his own faith, but he never forced it on others. I think I recall in the book that when we visited the ranch in Crawford for an evening meal on the Friday night of a weekend we spent there, before dinner, he invited everybody to join hands to say grace, and he did it in such a genuine and natural way that any non-believer in that group, and there were probably a dozen of us, any of the others who may have been non-believers, wouldn't have felt in any way embarrassed or out of place. He had a grace, no pun intended, in his handling of those things, which I respected.
So how have you been reflecting back on the significance of the events of September
11? Well, I've tried to do it in the context of what has been achieved and what hasn't been achieved over the last 10 years. In the fight against terrorism, and we've had more successes than failures. We had the terrible attack in Bali that claimed 88 Australian lives. We've thankfully taken out bin Laden, and also decapitated many of the other military leaders of Al-Qaeda. We are still in Afghanistan, but we're making progress. Sadly, we've lost 29 Australian soldiers, and many others have been wounded, some horribly. That weighs on my mind a great deal, because I was the Prime Minister who first sent them there. I've reflected on all of those things, but when I look back on that 10 years, we have been able to contain terrorism and in many areas peg it back. We have a very strong relationship with Indonesia in the fight against terrorism, and that's important because Indonesia is the largest Muslim nation in the world, and it's important in this fight against terrorism to have moderate Islamic people on our side, and the leaders of Indonesia are certainly in that category. So we have made progress, and I hope we stay the distance in Afghanistan. I support the approach of the current Prime Minister. I think Julia Gillard's position on Afghanistan is correct, and I'm glad that it's a bipartisan position and she has the steadfast support of the opposition.
Mr. Howard, I'm sure our listeners would be very interested to know, 4 years now after losing the Prime Ministership, what life is like for you
well,
now.
Life
no
is...
doubt it's very full still.
Life is very full, it's very good. I retain good health. I've got a wonderful family. I've got plenty of friends. I've got plenty to do. And people say to me, do you miss being Prime Minister? My answer is yes, I do. But have you adjusted to not being Prime Minister? Yes, I have. I had a very long run. The Australian people were very generous and tolerant and forbearing of having me as Prime Minister for so long, and I was grateful for that huge privilege. That life has moved on, and it's very good as it is in Australia, and I'm very grateful to my Maker that I have good health and got plenty of interesting things to do.
One thing I'd love to ask you in closing is, as you've stood on the sidelines from the Prime Ministership and seen the various travails, the inevitable travails of your two successors, quite apart from the politics of it, if I can ever get you to go there, do you ever feel sorry for them when you wake up and there's just the most terrible day and it just goes from bad to worse? You know what those days are like. Do you ever feel some degree of sympathy for them?
Oh, I guess on occasions one thinks, golly, what a terrible mess. I got to say, I have to be honest with you, it doesn't last all that long.
Shock me.
But, I mean, I don't wish them... Let me put it this way, Leo. I always think with questions like this, one has to be honest and not just make up some smarmy reply. I don't wish them any personal ill will. I wrote a note to Kevin Rudd's wife expressing the hope that he'd be restored to good health and back in the fray. I have no personal hostility to either of them. Clearly, when you've been a political combatant, you're a bit of a hypocrite yourself if you say you spend the day feeling sorry for the political challenges of people who've disagreed with you most of their lives about what you've done. I believed very strongly that my government left Australia in a very strong position. I don't think it's nearly as strong now, and I think the government has made a lot of mistakes, but I really don't want to inflict that the detail of that on your listeners. This is a bipartisan Christian radio network, and the last time I checked, God was neither Liberal nor Labor.
thank
heavens, yeah, it was for all of us, so we've got to be very respectful of the apolitical nature of the faith.
John Howard, very much appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Open House on this day.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.